From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I'm here in New York and I've just been convicted of trespassing for trying to deliver a petition to the UN.
Peace activists Cindy Sheehan and Medea Benjamin were trying to deliver a peace petition to the UN when they were arrested. They'll join us in our Firehouse studio to talk about the future of the peace movement in a democratically controlled Congress. Then Taking the Hill, a new documentary, documents the more than 50 war veterans who ran for office in midterm elections.
There are 62 veterans who are Democrats who are running for the House of Representatives. All of us have a wonderful shot at taking that experience, taking the flag out of the hands of Tom DeLay, and showing this president he can no longer use our military as a backdrop for political purposes.
We'll talk with candidate Tammy Duckworth and speak with the filmmakers who've done the film Taking the Hill. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has apparently confirmed for the first time Israel has nuclear weapons. On Monday, during an interview on German television, Olmert listed Israel among countries with nuclear arms. Olmert's comment came as he was asked about Iran's alleged nuclear program.
Israel doesn't threaten any country with anything, never did. The most that we try to get for ourselves is to be able to live without terror. But we never threaten any nation with annihilation. Iran openly, explicitly, and publicly threatens to write Israel off the map. Can you say that this is the same level when they are aspiring to have nuclear weapons as America, France, Israel, Russia?
After the interview, an Israeli government spokesperson denied Olmert intended to suggest Israel has nuclear weapons. Last week in Washington, incoming U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates said during his confirmation hearing that Israel has nuclear arms. Gates said it's a leading reason why Iran may be seeking its own nuclear weapons.
And I think that while they are certainly pressing, in my opinion, for nuclear capability, I think that they would see it in the first instance as a deterrent. They are surrounded by powers with nuclear weapons, Pakistan to their east, the Russians to the north, the Israelis to the west, and us in the Persian Gulf.
Israel is believed to have over 100 nuclear warheads, but it's never publicly acknowledged it. In Iraq, at least 57 people have died after a pair of car bombs exploded in Baghdad. Targeted in the attack were a group of day laborers seeking work. In Anbar province, 18 Marines have been injured after their helicopter was forced to make a hard landing. Three U.S. aircraft have gone down in the Anbar province in the past 2 weeks. The Pentagon also announced the death of three more soldiers in Iraq. 46 U.S. soldiers died in the first 10 days of the month, putting December on pace to be one of the deadliest months of the war for U.S. forces. On Monday, President Bush spoke at the State Department after meeting with advisors about Iraq.
Appreciate the advice I got from those folks in the field. And that advice is an important part and an important component of putting together a new way forward in Iraq. Like most Americans, this administration wants to succeed in Iraq because we understand success in Iraq will help protect the United States in the long run.
Today, the president is planning to hold a video conference with U.S. military commanders in Baghdad and U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Sameh Khalilzad. He is also expected to meet with Iraq's Sunni Vice President Tariq al-Hashimi in Washington. Meanwhile, a new CBS News poll found just 21% of Americans approve of President Bush's handling of the war. It's the lowest number he's ever received. Outgoing UN Secretary General Kofi Annan accused the United States of abandoning its ideals as it fights its so-called war on terror. Annan's comments came in an address to Independence, Missouri, at the library of former President Harry Truman.
As President Truman said, the responsibility of great states is to serve and not dominate the peoples of the world. He showed what can be done and what can be achieved when the U.S. assumes that responsibility. And still today, none of our global institutions can accomplish much when the U.S. remains aloof. But when it is fully engaged, the sky is the limit.
Kofi Annan also said human rights and the rule of law are vital to global security and prosperity.
Today, Americans, like the rest of humanity, need a functioning global system through which the world's people can face global challenges together. And in order to function more effectively, the system still cries out for far-sighted American leadership in the Truman tradition.
In the Indonesian province of Aceh, a former independence leader appears set to become governor after winning an historic election. Irwanda Yusuf is a former spokesperson for the pro-independence Free Aceh movement, or GAM. The elections were the first to be held since the Indonesian government and the GAM signed a peace agreement last year. Yusuf said he never expected to become governor of Aceh.
This is the dream of Acehese people being fulfilled, and they want change, fundamental change in all aspects of life and governance. And it will be hard work for me.
Irwanda Yusuf was jailed in 2003 for opposing the Indonesian government. He escaped in 2004 when the tsunami flooded his jail. In Chile, a funeral is being held today for the former dictator Augusto Pinochet, who died Sunday at the age of 91. Street celebrations continue in Santiago to mark the death of the man who brutally ruled the country for 17 years. Supporters of Pinochet lined up for hours on Monday to pay respects to the former dictator. Over 10,000 people filed past his coffin at Santiago's military academy. Meanwhile, street clashes between supporters and opponents of Pinochet continue. Over 100 people have been arrested. On Monday, Chilean President Michelle Bachelet called for calm.
In the last hours, we have seen gestures of division which we do not like. But I know that we have as a country, as a society, ethical strength to rediscover each other. That is the greatness of a country. The greatness is the intimate will of rediscovery based on historical truth. And the presidents of Chile should think of everyone in our past, in our future.
President Bachelet also said Chileans should not forget what happened under General Pinochet. She said, quote, "Only then will we have a constructive vision of our future, guaranteeing respect for the fundamental rights of all Chileans." Bachelet has decided not to attend today's funeral. She was once jailed and tortured under the Pinochet regime. The Spanish judge, Baltasar Garzon, who led a campaign to bring Pinochet to justice, also spoke Monday.
Thanks to a Spanish procedure with the Riggs Bank, we have recuperated $9 million that are being given to the victims through the Salvador Allende Foundation. I think that's an example of what justice can do when acting without borders and in coordination with the different countries involved.
General Pinochet died on International Human Rights Day. In Britain, the Observer newspaper reports cabinet ministers have been told by the Foreign Office to stop using the phrase war on terror. The British government said it wanted to avoid using language that could be counterproductive. The White House coined the phrase shortly after 9/11 attacks, but many British officials now feel the term has inflamed opinions around the world. In Iran, a group of students disrupted a speech by the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, on Monday. It marked the first major public protest against the president since he took office. The students screamed, "Death to the dictator," set photographs of the president on fire, and threw firecrackers at him. Ahmadinejad cut his speech short. As he left, students kicked at the car that carried him away. The president's guards did not remove the students or use force to stop the protests. Meanwhile, Iran is hosting an international conference questioning whether the Holocaust occurred. Holocaust deniers from around the world are attending, including former Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke, who claimed the gas chambers in which millions perished actually did not exist. South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu has sharply criticized Israel for blocking the United Nations from investigating the recent killing of 19 Palestinians in Gaza. Tutu was scheduled to head a fact-finding mission to Beit Hanun, but Israeli officials failed to grant him the necessary travel visas.
We find the lack of cooperation by the Israeli government very distressing, as well as its failure to allow the mission timely passage to Israel. This is a time in our history that neither allows for indifference to the plight of those suffering, nor a refusal to search for a solution to the present crisis in the region.
An Israeli government spokesperson said Israel was concerned about the mission's platform, saying it advances a biased anti-Israeli agenda. Congressmember Dennis Kucinich is planning to announce today he'll run again for president. The Ohio Democrat accused the leadership of his party of not pushing hard enough to end the Iraq war.
Our president does not seem to understand the necessity to get out of Iraq. Thus, it is imperative that Congress do the one thing the Constitution of the United States provides for. Congress must cut off future war funds and demand that the president use the current funds in the pipeline from the October 1st $70 billion appropriation to bring the troops home.
Congressmember Kucinich spoke Monday at a hearing featuring the authors of the recent Medical Lancet study that found as many as 660,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed during the war in Iraq. In environmental news, scientists are warning that within 30 years, the Arctic will almost be completely ice-free, making it possible for ships to sail to the North Pole. Global warming has caused sea ice in the Arctic to shrink at a record pace. A new study out of South Africa has found that the country's life expectancy has dropped by 13 years since 1990 because of the AIDS epidemic. The average South African now only lives to be 51 years old. A prominent Republican lawmaker is coming under criticism for apparently endorsing the assassination of Cuban President Fidel Castro. A new documentary called 638 Ways to Kill Castro features a brief interview with Florida Republican Congressmember Ileana Ross Leighton.
I welcome the opportunity of having anyone assassinate Fidel Castro and any leader who is oppressing.
Congressmember Ross Leighton was recently tapped to become the top Republican on the House International Relations Committee. She accused the filmmakers of splicing together her words, but she admitted to the Miami Herald she can't rule out that she ever mentioned Castro and a potential assassination. Ross Leighton said, quote, "If someone were to do it, I wouldn't be crying." In Britain, a series of anti-nuclear protests were held Monday to protest Tony Blair's push to develop a new generation of nuclear weapons. Two protesters managed to unfurl a banner inside Parliament that read, quote, "Sane government, not more missiles." 28 protesters were arrested in a series of actions across the country. And in media news, the FCC appears to be a step closer to approving the multi-billion-dollar merger of AT&T and Bell South. On Friday, the FCC's general counsel ruled that Republican FCC Chair Robert McDowell can vote on the merger. For the past year, McDowell has been largely prevented by ethics rules for participating in proceedings in which his former employer, Comptel, had been a party. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Monday, peace activists Cindy Sheehan, Medea Benjamin, Missy Beatty, and Reverend Patricia Ackerman delivered a peace petition to the U.S. mission to the United Nations. Hours before, a Manhattan criminal court had found the women guilty of trespassing for trying to do the very same thing in honor of International Women's Day last year. The women's peace group, Code Pink, had collected 72,000 signatures on a petition entitled Women Say No to War and attempted to deliver the petition to the office of UN Ambassador John Bolton on March 6th. The office refused to meet with them, and the women were arrested and charged with disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, trespassing, and obstructing government administration. The trial began December 5th and lasted a week. Yesterday, they were acquitted of all but the trespassing charge, and after the verdict was read, the women went back to the U.S. mission to try and deliver the peace petition again. This time, they were successful. Cindy Sheehan and Medea Benjamin join us now. Cindy is co-founder of Gold Star Families for Peace. Her son, Casey, was killed in Iraq April 4th, 2004. Medea Benjamin is a longtime peace activist and founder of Code Pink. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Hey, it's great to be here.
So you were found guilty
of the trespassing charge, which is very interesting because that's the only charge we were arrested for on March 6th. and we were supposed to just get a ticket and get out of jail. But the lieutenant told us from higher up, it said that they were going to add resisting arrest. So we had to spend the night in jail. We've had to spend 6 days in court on these piled on charges. And then we were just convicted of trespassing, which was the original charge. And I just think it was a huge waste of taxpayers' money and our time. And just really, it wasn't really private property. It was a U.S. mission to the U.N. where we were arrested on. So it was really, really incredible.
You did it again right afterwards. You
well, we felt compelled to make a point. We should never have been arrested in the first place. We had an appointment. We had no interest in doing civil disobedience. We had done this the year before. This is literally, Amy, handing a piece of paper to a person. This is a diplomatic mission. They should have taken the paper, shook our hands, said thank you very much, and gone about their business, and we would have gone about our business. Instead, they escalated, they dragged Cindy across the pavement, they forcibly took four women. They were trying to prove some kind of point, I guess, that they aren't really a diplomatic mission, that their aggressive policies towards the world are the same policies they use towards peace women at home. It was absolutely absurd, and sitting in court for 6 days on these charges, I think, showed them to be the ones who were in the wrong.
Did the now outgoing U.S. ambassador to the U.N., John Bolton, have anything to say about what you attempted to do, deliver these peace petitions?
Well, it was his office, so I think we can only take the assumption that he sets the tone in that office. But in the end, Amy, after we were convicted and we went back, the same people from the mission who testified against us in court had to come down, give us a big smile, and accept our petitions.
And what did the petition say exactly, Cindy Sheehan?
It was just tying in women's issues with war and peace. How we are the ones that bury our children, we're the ones that bury our husbands, and that when the women unite around the world, we will put an end to war. And it was not a threatening petition. You know, as the wording was very positive, very supportive of peace. Last year, in March when we tried to deliver it, we had five Iraqi women with us, and they saw how we were treated. One of the Iraqi women was punched in the stomach. And they just said on interviews, you're trying to spread freedom and democracy to our country, and this is the way you treat people in your own country, you know, harassed and abused for just walking down a public sidewalk and trying to deliver a petition, which even the Iraqi women understood that that's our right as Americans to do so. So it was just, you know, just a very positive, life-affirming petition. As Code Pink and Gold Star Families for Peace, we're just positive and life-affirming groups.
As we come dangerously close to that 3,000 number of soldiers mm-hmm. dead, U.S. soldiers mm-hmm. dead in Iraq,
right.
And now hear about, for example, the Lancet study mm-hmm. That says perhaps 660,000 Iraqis have died. You lost your son in Iraq, Casey. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts today?
Well, my thoughts are that it, of course, never should have happened. It's a war based on lies. I agree with Congressman Kucinich that we have to cut the funding. There's another bill coming up in the spring for appropriations bill for $130 billion, which will fund the war until the end of George Bush's administration. So he could just walk away, wash his hands of the whole entire mess. And we know in Vietnam it stopped when Congress stopped the funding. So we peace activists have to organize around the country in our own districts in Washington, D.C. to pressure our Congress people to vote no for future money to continue the killing. There's enough money only to complete this war through the end of June. And like Congressman Kucinich said, there's enough money to bring our troops home, and we have to start bringing them home. We have to start working diplomatically, and we've seen a firsthand experience that that's not what our government wants to do, but that's what it's going to have to do to stop the killing. It just gets worse and worse every day.
When we come back from break, I want to play for you an interview I did last night with the new senator from Ohio. Sherrod Brown, a Congress member for many terms, beat out the two-term incumbent, Senator DeWine, talking about his vision for this country and the Democratic plan as they move forward. And I want to talk to you about the plan for the peace movement. We're talking to Cindy Sheehan and Medea Benjamin. Stay with us. Give peace a chance here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Sherrod Brown is one of the six Democrats who defeated Republican incumbents in the Senate in November. Brown has served as a Congress member in Ohio's 13th District since 1993 and has been one of the most progressive lawmakers on Capitol Hill. He voted against the war in Iraq, against the Patriot Act, against warrantless wiretapping, and against the gay marriage amendment. The New York Times says Brown opposed President Bush's stated position more frequently in 2005 than any other member of Congress. In the early days of the invasion of Iraq, Brown took to the House floor nearly every night to read letters from constituents opposing war. I spoke with Sherrod Brown last night here in New York. He began by talking about his election in Ohio to the U.S. Senate.
I think that people feel in Ohio that their government betrayed them, that they've seen they saw a state government that was corrupt. They saw a federal government where the drug companies and the oil companies and Halliburton and companies like that simply had too much power and betrayed the middle class. And voters wanted a United States senator who would fight for the middle class and fight for working families and stand up for the poor.
Are you concerned about the voting in Ohio, the key battleground state, as we move into 2008 and even what happened now?
We have a new Secretary of State in Ohio who's terrific. She is as concerned about the electronic voting and concerned about the whole election system as anybody that's watching this or anybody I know around the country or in Ohio. I am very confident that in 2008 people's votes will count. I don't think they did in 2004. I think in 2008 they will.
You called for the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld in November of 2003. That's a long time ago.
Well, if Rumsfeld had held your job or the job of darn near anybody in America, he would have been fired long before he was. I mean, he clearly was incompetent. He clearly didn't tell the truth. He clearly continued to deceive. And, the war was wrong to begin with, but the way Rumsfeld argued for it and pushed the administration, and then his conduct of the war and his conduct of all the civil liberties questions around the war were simply wrong.
There's been a lawsuit filed against him in Germany by the Center for Constitutional Rights here in New York, charging him with war crimes. Do you agree with that?
I don't know. I don't know enough about the lawsuit. I do know that there will be and should be oversight investigations about his conduct of the war. There will be and should be oversight of Halliburton unbid contracts. And there will be throughout the Congress We need to hold them accountable. We still need to move forward on minimum wage. We need to end this war. We need to deal with helping middle-class kids get a college education. We also need to do the kind of investigative oversight that I think the public wants and that our government deserves and needs.
What do you think is the solution for Iraq right now?
I think the solution in Iraq is that we instruct the generals to come up with an exit strategy that will get us out of Iraq. I said in my campaign within 18 months, now I think the redeployment needs to be, as the situation's gotten worse, needs to be accelerated so that it's quicker than that. Otherwise, Iraq will never build their own security, police and military forces, and they'll never come to the compromise that they need to among the Shiites, Kurds, and Sunnis until we tell them we're leaving and this is when we're leaving.
Why not call for the troops to come home now?
Well, I think you call for, I think if we leave immediately, the Iraqis don't really prepare for our leaving. You give a date, it can be 12 months from now, it can be 18 months from now, but you begin the troop redeployment immediately, but you give them that end date when they need to be ready to take back their country.
What's going to be your first act in office as a senator?
My first act, I hope, is to vote for a minimum wage increase the first or the second day in office.
Well, you're leaving the House, and Nancy Pelosi has called for impeachment off the table and is against pulling the funding of the war. What are your thoughts as you move into the Senate on those two issues?
I think we, rather than impeachment or censuring of the president, I think we need, because that will look to the public as just more tit for tat. We need to do things for the country. That means increase the minimum wage, set up direct negotiations for drug prices, to get the Medicare law working for seniors rather than for the drug companies, pass the 9/11 Commission recommendations, pass middle class and working people incentives for going to college. We need to do things for this country. And the investigations of the White House, the investigations for wrongdoing should be part of that. But I don't want to get into looking like we're engaging in retribution. I want to do things for the people of this country.
Right before the election, you voted for the Military Commissions Act, which stripped habeas corpus. Why?
I think that if we had done nothing, the prisoners would continue in Guantanamo Bay with no resolution. That at least moved the process forward. They're either tried or they're freed. I didn't think they should be given more rights than American troops or a court-martial. I think we can fix that. I think we can make the bill better. I think we ought to go back and do that come this year.
Restore habeas corpus?
Yeah.
You would support that?
I would support that.
Would you introduce that?
Probably not. Because I have other priorities.
What are your priorities?
Well, my priorities are a fair trade policy in this country, increasing the minimum wage, going after the drug companies for the way that they charge and their whole pricing structure that have put absolutely amazing drugs out of reach for so many Americans.
And 2008, what do you think of what's going to happen? Are you coming out as an early supporter for any of the Democratic candidates?
I frankly don't have much opinion yet about who runs. My interest is that whoever runs the kind of populist campaign, stands up for the middle class, stands up for working families, the kind of campaign I ran in Ohio, because it's the question of whose side are you on. I want a presidential candidate not to move to the middle and stand for nothing, but to be a progressive voice that will stand up for working families, stand up for the middle class, stands up for people with less advantage. That's how you win elections. That's how you build a base to govern in this country the way that we should turn our government towards.
Finally, we interviewed a man this week, Lieutenant Aaron Watada. He's the first officer to refuse deployment to Iraq. He's about to be court-martialed. What do you say to soldiers who are saying no, they think it's immoral, they think it's wrong to go to Iraq?
I think you say that I don't know what you say. I think that there are a lot of people in this country that have had it with this war, and I think the best thing I can say to them is we want to end this war as fast as we can.
Do you think that there should be pressure on the military not to court-martial these men and women who are saying, just like many politicians, just like you have said, that the war is wrong?
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I'm not a military person. I've not... You know, the way military law works, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
The senator-elect from Ohio, Sherrod Brown, many-term Democratic Congress member. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We were speaking last night in New York. Medea Benjamin and Cindy Sheehan, two of the leading peace activists in this country, are with us in studio. Your response, let's begin with you, Medea.
Well, it's a shame that somebody who is so good on economic issues and one of our best allies in things like stopping the free trade agreements doesn't understand that the only way to stop this war is to cut off the funds. He avoided the whole question. You asked him, was he going to vote to cut off the funds? He didn't answer. The fact that he wouldn't praise Aaron Ouattara and those who are saying no to a war that he himself thinks is wrong is also a reflection of his inability to just be straightforward and say, the war is wrong, the troops have to come home, the only way we're going to bring them home is if we cut off new funding for the war. And I applaud those who say they're not going to fight in this war.
Your son fought in this war, Cindy Sheehan, and you lost him in Iraq. Your response to the issue of cutting off funds means you're not supporting the troops.
Well, first of all, he has a very ambitious domestic agenda. How is he going to get this through when we're spending $10 million an hour in Iraq? Where's the money going to come from? We need to take care of our people at home. Our troops should not be in Iraq. This month, almost five of them a day are dying. Nobody in Congress, nobody in the Senate has children over there. How many more are going to die in this 18 months? How many more Iraqis are going to be slaughtered? And we can't allow our elected officials to say that they're against the war if they vote for more money. Clearly, in Campbell versus Clinton in 1999, the Supreme Court said that our elected officials give explicit approval for war when they vote for funds. So we have to stop letting our elected officials say they're against the war if they're going to vote for funds. And our kids never should have been there in the first place. And the only way we can support them now is to bring them home, because they're not the ones getting these billions of dollars anyway. They're still going without so much. They're still going without things to help them survive. The people that are getting the money are Halliburton and Exxon and the private contractors there. So cutting off the funds means cutting off the profits for the war profiteers.
Medea Benjamin, your thoughts on the idea of immediate withdrawal today, tomorrow. You've been to Iraq many times. What about the assertions of the Iraqi government now, which ultimately criticized the Iraq Study Group, which wasn't even talking about an immediate withdrawal, concerned about abandonment?
I think our role as the peace movement is to say, bring the troops home now. If there is a timeline that is set that is the end of 2007, I would support that, because I think that gives a chance then to move towards a reconciliation plan where the Iraqis themselves could sit down and work out some kind of post-U.S. occupation government.
And do you see that happening?
I see it happening if we do our job, and what I see as the real danger ahead is the peace movement thinking, the Democrats are coming to power, there's a plan out there, let's give them a little time. This is the hardest time for the peace movement, and this is when we have to be the strongest. We have possibilities now coming up in January. As soon as they are sworn in the new Congress, we have to be there. January 3rd and 4th, Gold Star Families, Code Pink, and other groups are planning on being in Washington, D.C. We have a big mobilization. United for Peace and Justice is organizing for January 27th. We have the next anniversary of the war coming up, March 17th. We've got to be out on the streets. We've got to be in the offices of our congresspeople. If not, this war is going to go on, and we're going to be facing another presidential election with two pro-war major candidates from the Democrats and Republicans.
You were just in South Korea, both of you, Medea Benjamin and Cindy Sheehan. Why?
We were invited by Korean peace groups to come. We went to a village, Daichuri, in Pyeongtaek by Camp Humphreys, a U.S. military base that is slowly eating the entire village. It's taken their farmlands. It's demolished their houses. Part of the reason they're taking their lands is for a golf course. So we went there to resist this creeping and cancerous militarism basically around the world that is compromising and oppressing peoples in other countries, and this is U.S. militarism that's going on. And also the people of South Korea that we talk to want unification, and they say that with North Korea, reunification, they say that can't happen with the U.S. military presence there. So we just went as part of a delegation to stand in solidarity with the Korean peace movement, with the anti-militarism movement there in South Korea.
Medea Benjamin.
We also were there because South Korea has the third largest contingent of troops in Iraq after the U.S. and the U.K. And so there has been a movement in South Korea to force the government to bring their troops home. In fact, we met with members of parliament from all the different parties who had just returned from Iraq and said South Korean troops have no business in Iraq. So we were there to support that movement to bring their troops home.
Speaking of meeting with members of legislative bodies, soon after the Democrats took over Congress, you and a group of people went to meet with Nancy Pelosi. Does Nancy Pelosi, is she your Congress
Yes.
member? And she is also the first woman Speaker of the House. What did she say? What are your comments about her saying the cutting off of funding for the war is off the table, the cutting off of impeachment is off the table?
We say nothing is off the table, that Nancy Pelosi has to represent the voice of the people in her district first, which is the most progressive district perhaps in the country. We have already voted very democratically that we want to see President Bush impeached. We've already voted that we want to see the troops out immediately from Iraq. So she has to represent her district. And we have an opportunity right now, with her having this powerful position, to really put the pressure on her. So I'm very anxious for the new year to start, because we have plans both in her district and at her office in Washington, D.C., to say she must be a leader, she must listen to the people. She can't decide she's taking off the table something that is so important to now the majority of people in this country, which is end the war. And the only way you're going to end the war, Nancy, is not talking bad about President Bush's policy, but cutting the funding for the war.
The last act of outgoing Congressmember Cynthia McKinney of Georgia was to call for the impeachment of President Bush. Your response, and also to her ouster. She will be leaving Congress now, Congressmember McKinney.
Well, Madi and I both were in Georgia the day of her first election when she failed to get enough votes to, she had to have a runoff. Cynthia McKinney has been a very outspoken and very courageous member of Congress who, was very outspoken against the war, against George Bush and his policies. And I believe that impeachment needs to be talked about. It needs to be debated. It needs to be discussed, but it has to be from the people. We have to put pressure on Congress. It can't come from a special prosecutor. It can't come from anything else, but we the people saying that we want it on the table, that we set the table. And when that happens, then Congress will have the courage to do the same thing. So I just believe that Cynthia McKinney's proposal just brought the debate out, and we just had a whole weekend full of impeachment forums, 60 of them all over the country. I spoke with Liz Holtzman, who sat on Richard Nixon's investigative body, and it has to be reasoned, it has to be reverent, we have to obey the Constitution, we have to take everybody's feelings into consideration. It has to be nonpartisan for it to be effective. Bill Clinton's impeachment was a miscarriage of the Constitution. It was a travesty. It wasn't good for the country. But I believe George Bush's impeachment and removal from office will be good for the country and good for the whole world.
And your response to the outgoing Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld visiting Iraq for a final time in that surprise weekend trip?
Well, I think we're delighted that Donald Rumsfeld is gone. Not that Robert Gates is such a great replacement, but I think it's important that we see some of the worst warmongers leaving. We're delighted that John Bolton is leaving from the United Nations. And we're looking forward to a new year where the peace movement feels reinvigorated.
We want to thank you both for being with us, Madea Benjamin and Cindy Sheehan.
Thank you, Amy.
Cindy is one of the founders of Gold Star Families for Peace, lost her son Casey on April 4, 2004 in Sadr City, Iraq. And Madea Benjamin is one of the co-founders of Global Exchange and Code Pink. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to speak with a woman who ran for Congress in Illinois and lost. She was an Iraq War veteran. Her name was Tammy Duckworth. And we're going to talk about a film that looks at four Congress members who ran, one of whom who won. The film is called Taking the Hill. Stay with us.
Most Niger, Rastafari, live and never die. Yo, you know what I'm gonna fight for? What I'm also hype for? I fire light, you know. Oh, you better off. Show love, cause there is hope, yeah. Hey, do not fight.
Sizzla, No More War, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. One subplot of this year's midterm elections was the record number of candidates, more than 50, who once served in the armed forces. A new documentary premiering tonight on the Discovery Times channel chronicles five of the candidates as they hit the campaign trail. Rick Bolanos of Texas, Tammy Duckworth of Illinois, Andrew Horn of Kentucky, Eric Massa of New York, and Patrick Murphy of Pennsylvania. Their range of experience runs from Vietnam to Iraq, but they all ran as Democrats in opposition to the Bush administration's handling of the Iraq War. The documentary is called Taking the Hill, and it's by the filmmaker brothers Craig and Brent Renault, our colleagues here at Downtown Community Television. Their last documentary, Off to War, followed members of the Arkansas National Guard as they deployed to Iraq. Craig Renault joins us now here in the studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Craig.
Thanks for having us.
So this film, lay it out for us.
Well, we had actually just finished Off to War, and we got a call from a veteran who was organizing an event. Eric Massa and a guy by the name of Mike Lyon were organizing a gathering of about 42 veterans at the time who were going to come out to Capitol Hill and make an announcement and declare their candidacies for office. And so we went down to film it, and we're just amazed because this was back in February. It was months before any of the generals were calling for the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld. And here you had a group of military veterans who had fought in wars standing in front of Capitol Hill saying things that hadn't been said yet, calling, you know, telling basically President Bush that he could no longer use the military as a political backdrop for political purposes. So we were just amazed to see so many veterans to come out and actually run for Congress. So we started filming the documentary at that point.
Now, of these five, one.
Of the five that we followed, only one won. Out of the 62 that ran, only four won. So we were amazed by that because this was the most veterans you had running for office at any time in U.S. history. And at the end of the campaign, now 2007 Congress will have less veteran representation since before World War I. So, you know, considering how much talk there was about the war in Iraq in this particular election, it was surprising to us that so few veterans were actually elected to Congress.
Let's go to an excerpt of Taking the Hill. In this clip, New York candidate Eric Massa is on the campaign trail when he gets a visit and some campaign orders from Illinois Congressmember and Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee Chair Rahm Emanuel.
Hey, who's Congressman? Thank you, sir.
Hey, Eric, how are you?
Thank you for being here today.
Yeah, not a problem. How you doing?
Doing well.
I don't want you tonight on TV to be angry.
All right.
Okay, just let's take it down a notch.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah,
look.
Good. There are 62 veterans who are Democrats who are running for the House of Representatives. All of us have a wonderful shot at taking that experience, taking the flag out of the hands of Tom DeLay, and showing this president he can no longer use our military as a backdrop for political purposes.
Most of those people in Congress don't have your experience. I'm not asking you to be angry or anything like that, but you can say words and have the courage to say it that we do not have enough people like you right now, and that's why I hope you win. And I'll do everything I can to help you.
Thank you very much. We'll catch you in a little bit. We have to head to our next event. Thank you all very, very much. God bless. I never had an admiral walk on my ship that wasn't inspecting me. So I think that anybody in the military knows that a visit from higher headquarters often brings bad news. He wants to fine-tune me. He wants to refine me. And my problem is I am who I am. And that's, I'm not very refinable. He thinks I'm too fiery. Did I sound angry?
You always sound angry.
I don't think they like the idea that I brought up all the other veterans running. But I do everywhere I go. Obviously, Congressman Manuel's not a veteran. And so when the guy sits there and says, you have what we need, the implication is that people who are not veterans in Congress don't have what we need. And that rankles some people.
They're going to support you?
Well, he said, hey, listen, I'll invest money wherever there's money already invested.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's following that.
Yeah.
So if you have people I can call, friends, family, $100, $500,000, max is $4,200.
Yeah. See you guys. Good luck.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Good
luck. I hope
that
phone call worked.
I hope so. We'll follow it up.
Yep. Hey, can I grab Eric for 1 second? Do you mind?
Excuse me, Al.
You got to raise $200,000 per month for the next 4 months.
I know.
Okay? No, there's no, otherwise it ain't going to happen.
I agree.
Okay, so don't let your family down. Second, you've got to smile. Have fun. If all people see is anger, they'll see anger. Do you ever remember a person not likable winning? Okay, be likable.
All right, got it.
Rahm Emanuel, he has got a hold of the purse strings for the Democrats who run for Congress, head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Speaking to Eric Massa of New York, who is a veteran of Desert Storm, he ran in the Rochester area of New York and lost to Randy Kuhl, the Republican incumbent. Craig Renaud with us now. Craig, explain what we just watched in this excerpt of Taking the Hill. You basically have Eric Massa wired because you're following him, and Rahm Emanuel is taking him to the side and saying, don't be angry, don't be angry.
Right. Yeah, this, you know, this was an issue for all the candidates throughout the campaign. It's just one of the things that I think a lot of them didn't realize early on when they first declared was how much money it was going to take to run their campaign successfully. And one of the benchmarks that they were all given was basically, until you can raise $1 million on your own, you're not really a viable candidate. And so Eric Massa in particular, throughout his entire campaign, he was very successful at raising a good amount of money. He, by the end of the campaign, he raised over $1 million without any corporate PAC money, pretty much on individual donations, but yet he was never fully able to get the support of the party. So what you see in this scene is a visit by Rahm Emanuel to basically assess and evaluate Eric's campaign at this point in terms of his ability to raise money.
Does Rahm Emanuel respond to this film yet, Taking the Hill?
We're not sure. You know, we're not sure. We haven't heard yet.
And what was exactly he saying about the amount of money?
You know, it's something that was pretty out there and open in terms of the amount of money that Eric needed to raise at that point. You know, one of the things that he had said is that he needed to raise $200,000 per month.
This is what Rahm Emanuel told him.
Exactly, to be viable, to be able to compete and to have any chance of beating the incumbent that he was running against. One of the things that happened with Eric Mast at the very end of the campaign, you know, according to Eric, the Republican National Committee came into his district, spent $750,000 in the last week or so of the campaign. And so even though Eric was able to raise $1 million, he didn't have any money left at the end to counter that, and he actually ended up losing by less than 1%.
Hmm. Well, Tammy Duckworth is one of the Iraq War veterans who ran for Congress in November, profiled in Taking the Hill. She served as an Army helicopter pilot in Iraq. She lost both her legs and damaged her right arm when her helicopter was shot down in an RPG attack north of Baghdad. Tammy Duckworth ran for Congress on the Democratic ticket in Illinois' 6th District. She lost by just 2% of the vote. She was recently appointed director of Illinois Veterans Affairs Department by the governor. Tammy Duckworth joins us now in Chicago. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. How are you today?
It's very good to have you with us. As you reflect back on your time as you ran, talk about what you think worked and didn't, and also about what we just listened to. Rahm Emanuel, in this case, talking to a vet in upstate New York about what he had to do to make money.
Well, you know, I think what worked for me was just getting out there and being myself and talking to people. What worked was the fact that I was not a career politician, but someone who had served this country my entire adult life. And in that, you know, people understood the drive, the commitment of us veterans who were running, because none of us ever wanted to become politicians. We were running because we came from a place where we served our nation, and we're just appalled that our nation was headed down this wrong path. With the conversation that you just watched with Eric Massa and Congressman Emanuel was really funny, because I had the same conversations. I ended up raising over $4 million in my race. Overall, we spent about $6 million. But, you know, just to same thing happened to me that happened with Eric. The Republican Party came in at the last minute and spent an extra $2 million. They ended up spending $11 million against me. And so, you know, there was just such an overwhelming flood of money on the other side that you get to a point where no matter how much money you raise, they were going to outspend you. And in these close races, it does come down to money. I mean, I lost by 2,000 votes. Eric lost by, you know, less than 1%. And it was that same way all across the country. You can have you can be out there talking truth to power, but ultimately at the end, we just couldn't withstand the tide of money that was coming against us.
If the Democratic Party had given you more money, could you have done it?
If there had been money spent right at the end to counter the flood of negative, I think so. You know, we lost by 2,000 votes, and most of that was a result of the 74 pieces of negative mail that came out against me and the last 2 million in negative TV commercials that came out right in the last, I would say, 3 days. So, you know, it comes down to money. The Republican Party went into debt at the last minute, and I think the Speaker drew a line in the sand. My district was one where my western border was Denny Hastert's, and the eastern border was Rahm Emanuel. So I always joke that my district was a DMZ between the two parties.
Tammy Duckworth, why did you decide to run? And talk a little about your experience in Iraq.
Well, it was sort of slow in coming. In Iraq, I was one of these people who went out and kicked down doors. I flew helicopters, so I was sort of above the fray in a lot of things. And then right at the end there, I was injured. And what got me thinking about running was the fact that in March of 2005, I was injured in November of 2004. So just about 3 months after I was injured, I was asked to testify to the Senate and then to the House Veteran Affairs Committee about what I thought injured veterans were going to need in terms of support from this country for the rest of their lives. And I went into the Senate VA committee, and I had prepared this testimony, done a lot of research. The senators put their arms around me, had their pictures taken with me, called me a war hero and all of these things. And then the chairman of the committee proceeded to ignore everything I had to say and tried to get me to say things that were not true in the middle of this hearing. And I realized this man does not care what I have to say. He has an agenda, and it is not the interests of the veterans, and he doesn't care. And then a few weeks after that, I found out that they had cut funding for research out of the VA budget by $9 million to include funding for amputee research. I still had stitches in my legs from where they took my leg off, And I find out that after I testified on the Hill, they cut funding for amputee research, and that just made me mad. And you don't want to get a bunch of vets mad, because we stand up and fight for what we think is right then. And so it was a slow progression of realizing that people were not listening to us. People were not listening to the military commanders on the ground in Iraq and to those of us who had come home. And just getting to the point where you decided, you know, maybe it is time for me to do something. Maybe it is time for my generation to step forward, because certainly the Vietnam generation had and the World War II generation had before them.
Tammy Duckworth, I'm looking at a transcript of an interview that CNN senior national correspondent John Roberts did with you right after you won the Democratic primary in Illinois, asking if your, quote, narrow victory indicated maybe this idea of running Iraq war vets for the Democratic Party isn't as hot an idea as some Democrats originally thought it was. Later in the interview, Roberts noted that some political analysts, who he emphatically described as very smart, don't think that the Iraq war veteran thing is going to work for the Democratic Party, and that you're not going to win the overall race, and that you're being held out there as sacrificial lambs just to get the Democrats a little more credibility. Your response?
Well, my race wasn't focused on the Iraq war. My race was focused on health care. And I think the best explanation of how well we did was the fact that any time my opponent and I was competed for an endorsement where we were given equal shot at taking the endorsement, I won. I won every single newspaper endorsement, the Chicago Tribune, the Sun-Times, the Daily Herald, every single major newspaper endorsement in the district, I won. I won the Fraternal Order of Police endorsement after they initially had endorsed my opponent in the primary. And any time that it was a third-party, nonpartisan, unbiased critical look at the two of us on all of the issues, I came away with the endorsement. So I think it was important that I had focused my campaign not so much on Iraq as on the need for change in this country. But ultimately, we didn't have the money that my opponent did.
Craig Renaud, this film was scheduled to air before the election by Discovery Times, but it didn't. It's airing tonight.
Yeah, there was some discussion early on when we first started filming this about possibly doing this as two parts, one part that would air before the election and another part after the election to show the results. And then as we went along, the decision was made basically to wait until after the election. The concern really was that, you know, especially with all these candidates being Democrats, all the veteran candidates being Democrats, the concern mainly was, you know, not influencing the election one way or the other.
Tammy Duckworth, do you think if this had run when it was scheduled to run, it would have made a difference?
You know, I don't know. I think that ultimately in my race, it was about money and just being so totally outspent by the other side. I think for some of the other candidates, it may have helped a little bit. But this election cycle really wasn't. Yes, overall, the theme was about Iraq, but I think if you look at the individual races where you had an open seat and you didn't have an incumbent where you could you rail against their vote on the war, it wasn't about the war always. It was about, you know, the change in direction and health care and those things.
Do you have plans to run in 2008, Tammy? We just have 10 seconds.
I haven't ruled it out, but, you know, right now I have a job to do to advocate for veterans, and I'm going to work as hard as I can on this new mission.
Craig Renaud, when does this film air tonight?
It airs tonight at 9 p.m. on the Discovery Times channel.
I want to thank you for being with us. Craig Renaud, together with his brother Brent Renaud, Arkansas filmmakers, have directed the film Taking the Hill, premiering tonight. And Tammy Duckworth ran for Congress. Thanks so much for both being with us. That does it for the broadcast. Our website is democracynow.org, where you can read the transcripts. We video and audio podcasts there. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich and Aaron Mate, Lee Burek, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Special thanks to Uri Galed, Angela Alston, Hugh Grant, Megan Whitney, Samantha Chamblee. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.